through 14, verse 23. And as you are able, please rise for the reading of God's holy word. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people present with him, about 600 men. Saul, Jonathan, his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin. But the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned onto the road to Ophrah, to the land of Shual. Another company turned to the road to Beth Horon. And another company turned to the road of the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Now, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make swords or spears." But all the Israelites who would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for the sharpening was a pim for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Jonathan and Saul. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. Now it happened one day that Jonathan the son of Saul said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other Senna. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart." Then Jonathan said, "Very well, let us cross over to these men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, 'Wait till we come down to you,' then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and his knees with his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Gibeah, the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor's, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth Avon. Thus far the reading of God's word. You may be seated. It's not uncommon during times of war for weapons to be confiscated and for them to be hard to come by. During World War II, the Allies had to airlift weapons and smuggle them into the resistance in order that they might fight against the Nazi occupation. It was difficult work. It was dangerous work. Farmers would siphon aircraft fuel from downed planes, and if they were caught with that, they could face imprisonment or worse. Anything so that the oppressive Nazi regime would continue to occupy Europe. That was the goal. Keep them defenseless in order that we, the Nazis, might have the victory. And the odds of victory against the Nazis seemed so depressingly low at times, and yet the resistance continued. Can you imagine what it would have been like if the occupied European nations had no weapons whatsoever? How difficult would those battles have been? How overwhelming the opposition forces would they face would be? In our text, you will see that while the nation of Israel was completely weaponless in the face of the Philistine armies, yet God delivered them from under their oppression. Saul has just been made king. He has been chosen essentially by the people, for they wanted a man who was after, who would be like all the other nations. They wanted a man to lead and to go into battle. And we find ourselves here with the nation of Israel on the eve of a major battle, a major skirmish with their Philistine oppressors. It's interesting, but not very many things have changed for the nation of Israel. Remember last time that Saul had grown impatient and didn't wait for Samuel to come to offer the sacrifices as he had been commanded. And this was particularly egregious since they had been warned that they were to obey God and follow his commands. And if they did not do so, that they were in danger of being swept away. But Saul had offered the sacrifices, hoping to get a jump start so that when Samuel came, he could finish up the sacrifices and they would have fulfilled their obligation to God, and they could go right to the battle and be victorious. Well, you remember the consequence that Saul was told, your kingdom has been taken from you. You shall not establish a dynasty. Your children shall not rule on the throne. And it's kind of sad when you think about that in light of Jonathan as he is described for us in the scripture, and as you see him live and act in our passage before us. But nothing has really changed. The heart of the people of Israel is the same, often doing what is right in their own eyes. But what's different about this oppression of the Philistines? And you remember that cycle that when Israel was disobedient, God disciplined them by sending oppressive nations. And when they couldn't handle it anymore, they cried out in despair. And then God would deliver them. Well, we have the same cycle here, in that Israel was disobedient to God, and he sent upon them the Philistines to deliver them. But the difference between this account and the account that you'd find in the Judges is that in the Judges, God would send a judge, a deliverer, after the oppressors had come. But here we have a king who was on the throne, who had been established to lead God's people, to go before them into battle like all the other nations. And yet he's ruling over a kingdom that is under great oppression by an enemy nation. And you have in this passage, unlike in many of the accounts in the Judges, it goes into great detail as to the battle and as to what is to take place. Last time we looked at this passage in 1 Samuel chapter 12, you learned that you are to trust God even when everything appears to be lost. As Israel, Jonathan had attacked the Philistine garrison, and the Philistines were coming and were going to overrun Israel. And they were then on the cusp or the eve of this battle. And I want to show you by God's grace today that God works through the faithfulness of his people. You'll see Israel's severe bondage, then Jonathan's sincere trust, and finally God's supernatural deliverance. First of all, the severe bondage. The Philistine nation severely oppressed Israel in retaliation for their insurrection against them. Notice how our text begins. It begins with the Philistine raiders coming upon them. And Samuel arose and went from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. Saul numbered the people with him, and Saul and his people were present with him in Gibeah of Benjamin. Actually, the first thing that we see is that there was a parting of ways between Saul and Samuel. After having rebuked Saul, Samuel departed, and he went to Gibeah of Benjamin. Now, Samuel, who went to Gibeah, it was Saul's hometown. And a little later on we learn that Saul and his people were also in Gibeah of Benjamin. They had been in Gilgal, where the same place where Saul had been coronated as king, crowned as king, and where the kingdom had been taken from him. While Samuel went to Gibeah of Benjamin, what did Saul do? Notice that Saul numbered the people. That is, he counted them. He called them together as if for an inspection. And this is the word there that's used for numbered the people. It's the same word that's used later on in chapter 14 when Saul wanted to find out who is missing. And he said, call the roll. Count the men to see who is absent from our lines. And you notice that there was only about 600 men, which was, depending on how you look at it, 20% of the 3,000 men that were with Saul in the previous chapter, or 30% of the 2,000 men that were directly under Saul's control. Of the 3,000 men that he had, only 600 remained with him. What happened to all the rest? Well, you remember, they all went and they hid in rocks and caves and cisterns and pits. They were terrified and horrified because of the Philistine armies that had come upon them. And only 600 men remained faithful. That doesn't seem like too many soldiers, does it? But notice then that the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies, one on the road to Ophrah, one on the road to Beth Horon, and one on the road to the border that overlooks the valley of Seboim in the wilderness. You have the scene set out and laid out before you. Saul and his men are together, 600 of them. You've got the Philistines that are in Michmash, which is right on the eastern side of the mountains, just before you go into the Jordan Valley. And they send out from them, from this massive army, raiders. Now, the word that is translated raiders here comes from a word that means destroy. They sent out destroyers to go throughout the land to quell any rebellion that might come about because of the Israelite desire to be autonomous, to have self-rule. These were violent enforcers, bands of men tasked to control Israel, attempting to prevent the Israelites from gaining access into the mountains and thus cause all kinds of difficulty for the Philistine army. These were vicious men. They were destroyers. They were violent men, seeking to control and controlling by force the Israelite land. Again, I can picture from things that I've seen and heard in World War II of the soldiers marching up and down the streets of the city with their guns in hand and grabbing anybody who might be out after curfew or seeking to find resistance fighters and in order to imprison them and to kill them. It's that sort of picture that you have of these raiders. But notice, too, that there was the Philistine monopoly. There was no blacksmith throughout all the land of Israel. And I always, since I've been young, always found this interesting. No blacksmith. How in the world are you going to fix anything of any iron implement if you have no one who is able, who has the skills to be able to do it? Well, there was none. There was not a single Israelite blacksmith in all of the land. You see, you get here a picture of the setting of the territory, of the context within which these events occur. The Philistines were in full control of the nation of Israel. They had like 30,000 chariots, remember? What was it, 6,000 horsemen and people without number, a vast army, just all over the territory of Israel. And there was no blacksmith. And why was there no blacksmith? Well, the Philistines were afraid of the Israelites. They said, lest the Hebrews make sword or spears. They wanted to keep them defenseless in order that they might be able to more easily keep control of the Israelite population. They were afraid of Israel, but they were also afraid of Israel's God, for they knew the power of God. And so they did everything they can to prevent Israel from having any weapons of war. And you see later on that they were very successful. There was no weapon found, no sword, no spear held by any Israelite at this time. Have you ever thought about that? No weapon at all. How did Israel come into the promised land? Even when they were wandering through the wilderness, they had weapons. They were able to defend themselves. And now here, they had none. God brought them into the promised land with weapons. They had used these weapons to destroy their enemies. They were to utterly destroy the nations. This was their land. It was given to them by right, as it were. And now they were absolutely defenseless. No swords anywhere. Well, except for two. Jonathan and Saul. They had swords. But what were two swords against such a vast army and among so many people? And since Jonathan and Saul were king and the king's son, it made sense. It could even be looked upon as sort of a status symbol for them that they had swords. But two swords against a mighty horde of the Philistines was nothing. And they had a complete monopoly. No blacksmith in Israel. And if Israel had anything that they needed to have fixed or to have sharpened, they had to take it to the Philistine blacksmiths. And they were the ones who would be able to police whether the Israelites had weapons or not. And in fact, since they're at it, we might as well make some money. And so they would charge a pim for plowshares and mattocks and forks and axe and to set the points of the goads. The goads are a stick with a sharp point that was used to drive large animals from behind. When I was growing up, we'd call them electric shockers because they were electrified. But they had the same effect of getting the animals to move forward. And it cost them a pim, which is about two-thirds of a shekel weight, or about 2.25 ounces. And that's about all that we know about this payment. Was it silver or was it grain or something? We're not exactly sure. But it was important because the writer noted it here. It must have been costly for them to get their swords or their plowshares sharpened and their forks and their hoes and their mattocks. And a mattock, by the way, is a combination between, there's two different kinds, a combination between a pick and a large hoe, or an axe and a large hoe was used to move the ground in order for them to plant, to prepare the soil. And without these tools being sharpened and being able to use, it would have been difficult for the Israelites to produce food and to grow food for them and to provide supplies for themselves. Here you have the severe bondage of the people of Israel. It was a very difficult time for them. For you see that God works through the faithfulness of his people, and the times were very, very hard. But notice Jonathan's sincere trust. Jonathan trusted in God to deliver him. As Jonathan exposes himself to the Philistines, whom God, throwing into confusion, gives into his own hands. Jonathan is desirous of entering into the enemy territory. Now it happened one day that Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor. It's not a fairy tale intro. It describes Jonathan's activity on one day, and it almost seems as if he's bored, but he's not. Impatient, perhaps. Bored, no. You see, there's something about Jonathan that is different than his father. There's something about Jonathan that is different than the other Israelites that you don't meet by name, but you read about in terms of them being the army and the soldiers and those men with Saul. They were with Saul. Where was Saul? Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. But Jonathan, he wasn't sitting under a tree. He was with his armor bearer surveying the enemy territory. And he says, I want to go there. Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. He was impatient to act. He was tired of waiting. He was tired of wondering what is going to happen. He was tired of the oppression. He was tired of having to pay the Philistine blacksmiths to sharpen their plowshares and their axes and so on, and the Israelite army not having any weapons of their own. And so he says to his armor bearer, literally the one who bears his armor, the one who carries his weapons. I always used to picture the armor bearer as somebody who would stand in front of Jonathan with a shield, and then Jonathan would jump out and attack and then jump in behind. But that's not what was happening here. As you'll see later on, that Jonathan and his armor bearer worked in tandem. It was Jonathan who struck down the men, and it was his armor bearer who killed the men. As you will see, they worked together in this attack. But Jonathan, being the king's son and being a leader and growing impatient with the bondage upon underneath which Israel found themselves, he said, I want to go to the other side. But notice, he did not tell his father. There was not a lot of communication going on between the father and his son. The father was over by Migron, sitting under a tree, and Jonathan was here. And he knew, perhaps he knew full well what Saul was going to say. You cannot go. But why can't I go, Dad? They're an uncircumcised group, and the Lord will give them into our hands. No, you may not go. And so rather than ask his father, he simply went. He didn't tell his father. He didn't let him know what his plans were. And as I said, Saul was sitting. Now, you might get the impression from what I've said that Saul was simply being lazy, and I don't think that's what was happening here. He was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under this tree. It doesn't mean he wasn't doing anything. It just means that he was perhaps seeking the direction from God. We learn that later on from from Ahijah having the ephod, and from him calling for the ark of the Lord to be brought to him. Often one who sat under the tree would be a judge and make judgments. And I think that Saul was doing kingly stuff while sitting under this tree. But he was just not actively probing the battle lines. He was waiting for reports, and he had men who were watching the Philistines to see what they were doing. And notice we're told once again that with him were about 600 men. What is 600 men compared to the plethora of men at the disposal of the Philistines? And yet there he was, Saul, surrounded by 600 men, loyal men, brave men, but not very many men. And Ahijah the prophet was there. And you have the family tree of Ahijah. He was the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. He was related to Eli's family, and you know what happened to Eli's family, that it was to be wiped out, and that those of Eli's family would die young and not live to an old age, because Eli did not rebuke his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, when they were stealing and doing ungodly things with those who came to the tabernacle of the Lord. Yet we have Ahijah here. We're told that in the New King James, he is wearing, it literally means bearing the ephod. He was carrying it, he was guarding it, he was protecting it, because after all, he was from the priestly family. And it seems that he carried on some of those priestly functions, though the tabernacle was no longer in existence. And once again, it's repeated that the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. No one had any clue that he had left them. Now we find Jonathan in his incursion into the enemy territory. And notice the description of the territory. Between the passes where Jonathan sought to go over was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. The name of the one Bozez and the name of the other Senna. The front of one faced north, opposite Michmash, the other southward, opposite Gibeah. What you have here are two crags, two steep, rugged masses of rocks projecting upward. You get the picture that it wasn't smooth rock that you might find along the shore of the sea. Certainly not sand. It was jagged rock. And they were steep rocks, high rocks, sharp to the touch, and very difficult, you can imagine, to climb to the top. And you see, Michmash was at the top of near the top of one of those crags. And there was a valley, there was a ravine that Michmash overlooked, and Jonathan was on the other side. And that's where he was, in this steep ravine with these steep rocky cliffs on both sides of him. The enemy up there, Jonathan and his armor bearer below him. They were dangerous slopes, difficult to navigate, and making it hard for him to accomplish his set purpose. And Jonathan, being there, says, "Oh no, let's turn around and go back," right? Is that what he says? No. He says, "Come on, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." He calls to his armor bearer and says, "Come on, let us go over." And he reiterates his plan and his objective. "I want to go to the Philistine garrison, to that garrison of the uncircumcised." And that term uncircumcised was used by the Israelites in a pejorative sense. It was used of the Gentiles. For you see, the circumcision emphasized God's covenant relationship with Israel and their favored status. And anyone who was uncircumcised was outside of the covenant and did not enjoy God's favored status. This term uncircumcised identifies the nature of the Philistines' relationship with God. They were outside of the covenant promises of God. And it seems that Jonathan doesn't have much respect for the enemy. He sees them as God sees them, uncircumcised, and thus outside of the covenant. He says, come on, let us go to these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. Notice the trust that Jonathan expresses. It may be that the Lord will work for us. This is an incredible statement of faith in the face of overwhelming difficulty and opposition. It may be. This is not a doubt or a blind hope or a blind faith, an expression of, well, I hope that God will come in the sense that we use it today. No, this is a statement that acknowledges that God is not compelled to act. It may be that the Lord is pleased to give these Philistines into our hands. It's not a, oh, I hope and pray and wish and desire that maybe God might possibly, I don't know if he can, give these enemies into our hands. No, it may be that it's the Lord's will, that it's his desire to give them into our hands. It may be that the Lord will work for us, that the Lord will work and act in a way that we can't fathom or imagine even now. And notice the expression of faith. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Nothing restrains the Lord. Here Jonathan acknowledges God's sovereignty over all things. He is God over all, even over the circumstances which the Israelites are facing. And he says, nothing restrains the Lord. Nothing holds him back. Nothing can stop God from delivering the enemy into our hands, from rescuing Israel under the oppression and from the difficulties imposed upon them by the Philistines. You see, they cannot defend themselves. They have no sword. Marauding bands of destroyers roam the land as the destroyers have been sent out by the Philistine army. Their economic system is in disarray as they have to pay the Philistines to fix their implements. Perhaps the Lord, for nothing restrains the Lord. Nothing. This is a statement, brothers and sisters, of our God. Let us never forget this in the day and in the age in which we live. That we live in the midst of a society that has little or no respect of God, and we think, what can the Lord do through us, as small as we are, or as big as we might be? What can the Lord do? Brothers and sisters, nothing restrains the Lord from acting. He will do what he has purposed to do from before the foundation of the world. This is the God whom we serve and worship. And when you are filled with perhaps anxiety over what's going to happen or what you need to say, remember, nothing restrains the Lord from saving his church, from saving and rescuing you and me, and from accomplishing his purposes. This is the sovereign God that we serve. He says, nothing restrains the Lord, whether by many or by few. There. By many or by few. God can save by many. He can save by hordes. He can save his people with a vast army. But he can also save by a few. Remember this phrase, because it comes over and over again in this passage, and I've alluded to it already. Whether by many or by few. How many men did Saul have with him? 600. That's not very many, is it? Reminds you of Gideon, right? When Gideon had all that army, and he said, okay, those who are afraid, go home. And God says he still has too many. It says, go and make them drink out of the stream, and those that kneel down, and I believe it was lap like dogs, those are the ones who will go with you into battle. And how many were there? 300. And what's Jonathan doing? What does he want to do? He wants to go over to the garrison of the Philistines. And how many are with Jonathan? One. The two of them are going forward in faith. For Jonathan trusts in the Lord, that nothing restrains the Lord, and he is able to save by many or by few. Saul looks around and he sees the 600 men and says, what is that against 30,000 chariots and hordes of people without number? To God, that's nothing. To Jonathan, that's nothing because he trusts in the Lord. He trusts that the Lord will deliver him. And all of these things are working out according to God's holy providence. We confess that by the same providence, God orders all things to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily or freely. God, in his ordinary providence, makes use of means. Brothers and sisters, this means God makes use of you and of me in growing and strengthening his church. God makes use of means, difficulties, and trials to strengthen your faith and your trust in him. Jonathan faced incredible odds that he would be successful in his quest to go. But he had one thing, it seems, that his father had lacked. He trusted in God's sovereign providence to accomplish his purposes. And brothers and sisters, God uses the storm. God uses natural disasters, even wars, to accomplish his purpose. Nothing is outside of God's control. No flooding, no tornadoes, no straight line winds, no wildfires. And we've experienced all those here in our area. God uses all of them to accomplish his purposes, that you might trust in him, that you might see his sovereignty and bow before it, that you might worship him, that you might extol his name, that you might declare throughout the ages, you are worthy to receive glory and honor and power and dominion forever and ever. That's the true end of our worship. And that is the power of God whom we serve, who is able to deliver, whether by many or by few. What is the response of the armor bearer? Do all that is in your heart. Go, I am with you. The armor bearer expresses the same kind of trust in God that Saul does, that Jonathan does. So Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. Here's the plan. Basically, the plan is show ourselves and let's see what happens. That's quite a military strategy, don't you think? It probably wouldn't work in warfare today, at least not very well. But that was Jonathan's plan. Let's show ourselves and see what happens. Let's go over to the Philistines directly. Go directly to them. This would appear to be a very foolhardy plan. It would appear to put them in great danger. But remember, Jonathan wasn't too concerned, for he knew who was in control, that whether by many or by few, God was sovereign, and nothing restrains the hand of the Lord. And so he gives this detailed plan. We'll cross over and we'll show ourselves. If they say, wait till we come down to you, we'll stand and we won't go up. But if they say, come on up to us, we'll go up. Why? For the Lord has delivered them into our hand. This will be a sign to us. What shall we do? Shall we go directly? No, we won't go directly. What we'll do is we'll show ourselves to them. And then we'll seek a confirmation from the Lord as to whether we are to go up to them directly or whether we are to wait for them to come down. If they say, wait there, we won't go. It's not of the Lord's purpose for us to go to this Philistine camp. But if they say, come on up to us, then we will go, because God has given them into our hands. What trust and what faith. Now, this act of Jonathan and his armor bearer is not the same as what Gideon did. You remember Gideon and his fleece. Gideon asked for the fleece to be wet and the ground to be dry because he doubted that God would save, and he wanted confirmation of God's presence with him. And then he said, I want the ground to be wet and the fleece to be dry. But isn't that what Jonathan's doing? No. You see, Jonathan wasn't seeking confirmation. He was seeking direction. Lord, what do you want me to do? How do you want me to approach these Philistines? And we can learn from this to pray specifically and then look for specific answers to prayer. For God is pleased to use prayer to accomplish his ends. And too often we pray and then neglect to look for God's answers to our prayer. And so that's the detailed plan. Show ourselves and wait for them to respond. Either we go up, they tell us to come up, or to stay here. And depending on what they do, we'll know what the Lord would have us to do. And so they put their plan into action. They expose themselves. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. You can picture the Philistines up at the top, at the bottom of this ravine, and suddenly they see these two men coming out of the rocks. And you can picture what's going through the Philistine mind. Where are they finding the Israelites? Are they finding them in their homes? No, they're finding them in the rocks and in the caves and in the pits and in the cellars. They're finding them all over because they know that the Israelites are hiding from them. And they haven't seen any Israelites in a long time. And now suddenly, out of the ravine, appear these two men. These two Israelites just boldly walking forth. You can picture the laughter of these Philistines as they look upon these Israelites and as they call out to the men, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." The mockery, the contempt for which they viewed the Israelites is there displayed in that statement. Indeed, brothers and sisters, it's the same kind of mockery that unbelievers and unbelief shows for the church and for God's people. And they ridicule them. "Look, they're coming out of their holes. They've been in hiding, and now they're coming out." You see, sadly, this they'd rather hide than stand boldly before the Lord. But now notice the incursion. "Come up," they say, "and we'll show you a thing or two. We'll show you something." They're just so proud. They're so elated at this picture of these two paltry, pitiful Israelite soldiers coming out of the rocks. "Come on up," they say. "We'll show you something. We'll show you our power. We'll show you our might. We'll show you what we do to you, Israelite army." Then Jonathan says to his armor bearer, "Come up after me." You can picture the smile on his face almost, even though he's full of energy to go. You can picture the smile. "The Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. The Lord has given them to us." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and his knees with his armor bearer after him. And you get the picture of them scrambling up this rocky crag. Remember these two crags that were described? Painful. They couldn't just walk up. They had to climb on hands and knees. It was a difficult ascent. And perhaps even the soldiers were throwing rocks down upon them as they were climbing up. And yet they went undeterred, and they came to the top. And the Philistines thought, "We're going to make an easy meal of them. We're going to finish them off when they get to the top." And what happens? When they get to the top, the armor bearer comes, and he strikes them down. And the armor bearer comes, and he kills them. And we're told the first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land, by many or by few. You would have expected that Jonathan would have killed 200 or 2,000 men in this onslaught, but he kills only 20. What's 20 in light of this whole horde of the Philistine army? It's nothing. But whether by many or by few, the Lord would deliver them. Those 20 were enough that the Lord used it to create this confusion and trembling within the camp of the Philistines. For you see, God works through the faithfulness of his people. You see, God's supernatural deliverance. Confusion reigned among the Philistines. There was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison of the raiders also trembled. The earth quaked, so that there was a very great trembling. Do you notice how often that term trembling occurs here in this verse? Four times. Well, if you count in the New King James, only three. But where it says the earth quaked, that is that same word, the earth trembled. That as Jonathan attacked, the Lord sent an earthquake that shook the ground, that shook the camp. And not only did the camp tremble, and all those in the field trembled, and all the people, this massive horde, trembled, The garrisons and the destroyers trembled, and the earth quaked. And then it says, so there was a very great trembling. In the original, they have there, and so it was a trembling of God. It was God who sent this confusion among the people. God sent the earthquake. It was God's action and God's activity. That nothing restrains the Lord from delivering his people from the hand of their enemy, whether by many or by few. And you can picture this massive army and the clanking of the armor and all of the confusion that's going on. What's going on? As they hear this battle over there, and notice that the battle was only in about half an acre. Not in a very big area did Jonathan strike down these men that were going to show him a thing or two. But you see, the confusion was not only in the Philistine camp, there was also confusion in the Israelite camp as well. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah looked, and there was a multitude melting away. They went here and there. You can picture the swaying and the motion of the Israelite camp. And he goes and he reports to Saul and to the men with Saul and says, there's something going on in the camp. Then Saul said to his people, let's go and attack, right? Is that what he says? No. What's the first thing that Saul said? Call the roll. See who's missing from our ranks. He numbered the people again. He wanted to know who was gone. Why is it that the Philistines' army is in an uproar? And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were there. I always find this strange too. He calls the roll, find out that Jonathan and his armor bearer were there, and then for the rest, we know nothing about it. Later on in the next chapter, after Jonathan eats the honey and has the victory, and Saul is going to put his own son to death, and his people prevent him from doing it, there is still nothing about Jonathan going off to the Philistine garrison on his own. So they had no idea what Jonathan was doing. And Saul had no idea what was going on. And so rather than investigate the Philistine army, he investigated his own. Who is not here? And then he says to Ahijah, instead, let's go and examine what's going on. He says to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. Let's inquire of the Lord what we are to do. Yeah, I know there's something going on over there, but let's not worry about that. Let's find out what the Lord would have us to do. And then in the middle of the ark being brought and they're about to inquire, the Lord, he says to Ahijah, withdraw your hand. Literally, gather your hand. Bring it back to yourself. Stop. Don't bother bringing the ark. Now I'm going to go. Now I want to know what is happening. While he talked to the priest, the noise that was in the camp continued to increase. The hubbub was getting louder and louder. And it was becoming almost impossible to ignore it anymore. What's going on was the question that everybody was asking. Withdraw your hand. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to battle. Finally, they went to battle. Every man's sword they saw was against his neighbor. There was very great confusion in the Philistine army. And did you notice that there were collaborators in the Philistine army? There were Hebrews, perhaps mercenaries who were for hire, killers for hire to the highest bidder. They were with the Philistines. They left the Philistines and came and joined the Israelites. Perhaps they were even part of the confusion, striking down their neighbors, striking down their enemies, so that the Philistines began fighting and killing themselves. But the Philistines, they were thrown into such great confusion. They had no idea what was going on. And notice that God's people resist. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed after them hard in battle. They went after the Philistines to destroy them, to wipe them out, to rid themselves of their heavy hand of oppression. They followed hard after them. They attacked them. They struck them. They killed them. They drove the enemy from their land. That's the picture. As, remember, when Jonathan and his armor bearer came out, They laughed and mocked and said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the rocks. Well, now look what happened. As the Philistines were thrown into confusion, the Hebrews were coming out of the rocks, and they were attacking them from all sides, from wherever they were hidden, for they heard that the Philistines were on the run. And notice how this whole battle is summarized. So the Lord saved Israel that day. This was a battle that was fought and won by God. Yes, God used means. God used Jonathan. God works through the faithfulness of his people to accomplish his ends. But in the end, the Lord saved Israel. Once again, the Lord showed himself to be faithful to his people, who were a faithless people. You see, God continues to work for his people. God continues to deliver his people from the oppression of their sin. And you remember that Jonathan's confession that for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Brothers and sisters, we are and have been under bondage to sin. Sin is a cruel oppressor. It separates us from God, separates us from the one who made us. Who shall deliver us from this body of sin? The apostle cries out. Who shall deliver us from the hand of Satan? Can you do it? Can I do it? Whether by many or by few, brothers and sisters, God saves by one. God saves by his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. God delivers you from your sins and your trespasses. He declares you to be righteous in his sight for the sake of Christ and his death upon the cross. This battle wasn't about Jonathan's bravery. It wasn't about Jonathan at all. This battle was about God and what God would do for his people. And God continues to deliver his people by one. Not by a horde, not by the church. The church doesn't save. Ministers don't save. Elders don't save. Deacons don't save. Christians don't save. By one, Christ. Christ saves his people. Remember that in the midst of confusion and the difficulties of your circumstances, trust God to deliver you. It may not be easy. It will continue to be difficult, perhaps. But remember, God has saved you by one, by his only begotten Son. And remember that God uses faithful men and women to accomplish his purposes. Men who love him with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. He doesn't require a college degree. He doesn't require you to know 10 different languages. He simply requires you to trust in him and live that trust before the world, whether by many or by few. You can make a difference in the life of those around you by being faithful to the God who loved you and saved you by the power of his Spirit at work within you. To trust in anything other than God is utterly foolish. The end result is analysis paralysis or paralysis by indecision. And that seemed to be what has plagued Saul and what will plague Saul throughout his life. He didn't know what to do. He wasn't sure where to go. He wasn't sure whether to attack or not. And so he sought the direction of the Lord, and he was sitting with his men, 600 men under the tree, while the rest of his nation was in hiding under rocks. But one faithful man and his armor bearer went into the midst of the Philistine garrison and accomplished what 1,000 men could not do, what 3,000 men could not do. That God used the faithful obedience of Jonathan to deliver his people from their sin. And without trust in God, you will never know the peace in the times of trials. Though the odds of ending the Nazi occupation seemed hopeless, nevertheless, the Nazis were overthrown. While the odds may seem extremely low for believers, with God on your side, you cannot fail. For God uses faithful men and women, those who love him, those who are called according to his purpose, to accomplish his purposes. Trust in him, not in yourselves, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. That's the God whom we serve.